This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District, Houston's hidden gem, with a developer-friendly environment and Houston's sixth-largest business center. More information at nnmd.org.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thank you for joining us as we do our favorite thing every week, and that's talk politics. As always, Brandon, lots going on nationally and, of course, here in Texas. Earlier this week, we saw that the White House counsel, Don McGahn, was leaving. Just another in a long line of people exiting the White House. Is this more significant because of who he is? Or is this just, again, the normal turnover?
I think it's significant for a couple of reasons. I mean, number one, you know, he's the sort of figurehead who did a lot of work to vet Brett Kavanaugh, which we'll talk about more in the deep. So I think that it kind of caught some of the senators and Republican senators off guard, especially Chuck Grassley and Mitch McConnell, both of whom implored the president to keep him. The other is that, you know, he was one of the lone voices to keep John Mueller and not to have the White House mess with that investigation. So this is going to be a big change. Like you said, the Trump administration has witnessed a record level of turnover. And when you've got turnover in this level, it's potentially problematic for your administration's survival. But I think ultimately what the White House wants to avoid is having Don McGahn be the next John Dean, right, who became famous by basically flipping on Nixon and spilling the secrets of the White House. So this could be a problem because McGahn had talked with and cooperated with Mueller. So exactly what he said and what that looks like and what the effect will be, we don't know. But there's definitely some issue there.
Well, we know that, you know, politics drives so much of this, and we know that this is essentially a relitigation of 2016, but I bet you didn't know that 2020 campaign is essentially upon us now. We're seeing some of that in the Kavanaugh hearings, and we'll talk about that once we get into the deep. But the Democratic field is shaping up to be kind of back to the 80s, Golden Girls reboot. I don't know what you want to describe it, but with John Kerry is now not ruling it out. Joe Biden says he's still thinking about it.
Right.
We already know about Bernie Sanders. And of course, the young, fresh face is Elizabeth Warren. What does this say about—
At a young, what, 67,
yeah,
68 years old?
68 years old, right? What does this say about the Democratic Party when the state of their field, their bench, are folks that are all Social Security eligible?
Yeah. I'm gonna use a pun here, and that is that it's too early, right, for 2020. I think none of us are emotionally ready, but I also think that, frankly, like the young crowd hasn't solidified yet. I think that the hearings will kind of bring that out, right? We'll have Kamala Harris, who really has shown in the hearings, possibly Cory Booker. There's going to be a slew of younger people like Julian Castro, who is already visiting Iowa. We've talked about that. They will come. But at this point, it looks like that, you know, 2020 is the new 2004.
Right? Well, keeping our Back to the Future theme alive, we do have now a replacement for the late Senator John McCain. His friend and former colleague, John Kyle from the state of Arizona, was called in to replace him, who also had just retired not too long ago himself. He's coming in to fill in. And, you know, he has been on the record as quite critical of President Trump and his demeanor and his actions. But he is much more of a traditional conservative Republican, not nearly the maverick that John McCain was.
Yeah. I still think this is a safe bet, though, for the governor to appoint him. Kyle was a McConnell deputy, so, you know, McConnell's happy. Trump is happy because he's got a sure yes vote for the Kavanaugh hearings. Now the Republicans can basically afford to lose upwards of two votes, right? So there's more cotton around that bail. I do think that the McCain family was satisfied with this, too. So it could have gone a very different way. And the fact that he's not going to run for the seat, he says publicly, I think probably makes this what it should have been, which was a placeholder.
Yeah, exactly. A placeholder, a good political move by the governor there, who himself is in a strong reelection battle. And so it makes a ton of sense. And again, you create stability. And the McCain family was happy. And I think that there's some value in that in itself.
Well, Jay, the big explosive news of the week was really over a couple of big revelations. The first was Bob Woodward's new book, Excerpts, came out. The book is called Fear, which has not only instilled fear in much of the Trump administration, but also lots of people in the public. And an anonymous op-ed, which basically accuses the Trump administration and President Trump in particular of being sort of unqualified to serve as president. What do you make of all this? What's going to happen and what's the impact?
Well, the Woodward book, I think, is a collection of many of the things that we had heard about from other books, statements that were made kind of off the record. There's a lot of sort of corroboration. This was done, obviously done, Bob Woodward's two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, celebrated author, and I don't think anybody questions the authenticity that he brings to it, except, of course, the White House and the folks around President Trump. But the anonymous column that was written in the New York Times, I personally am find deeply troubling. You know, you just simply cannot make this argument that you are trying to provide some sort of loyal resistance while staying in the White House to sort of support it, and then at the same time undermining the president kind of in a backdoor way. I think it's unfair to President Trump. It's unfair to the American people. Either let him have his team, be a loyal soldier, or get out and make a statement that they should have put their name on it. Otherwise, yeah. I'm not sure it really solves anything.
I agree. On the Woodward book, many of these revelations, I think, are not that new, but they're chilling, nevertheless, to learn about them all together. And on the anonymous op-ed, I completely agree with you. I think it was irresponsible for the Times to run this. I think that it is impossible to read this in a truthful way because we simply don't know the authenticity of it. Some of those things were being batted around. Some of it's in the Woodward book. But I think, generally speaking, that this is not what the New York Times should be doing, and probably only further kind of fosters this notion that the press is sort of out to get the president. I don't think it's true, but this is not helping that case.
Well, Brandon, shifting gears to Texas, we've got a lot going on here in the Lone Star State. Big news of the week, really on a policy side that doesn't get covered as much, I think, as it needs to be, is this ongoing problem with special education here in Texas. The Texas Education Agency is coming under tremendous fire for essentially kind of this illegal, unauthorized contract for special education services that they put out. What exactly happened here, and what does this really mean?
Apparently, the TEA had lacked adequate safeguards to identify potential conflict of interests between top officials, who was an acquaintance with a subcontractor on a multi-million-dollar no-bid contract. The irony here is that the state has not yet learned its lesson, right? We went through this 2-3 years ago, and we continue to have these sort of contract problems. We have talked about this issue before. I mean, the specifics of this, of course, in my opinion, are worse because you've got one of the most fundamental things that the state does, which is public education, and one of the most critical and sensitive things, and that's special education, is now being called into question, and the state spending more money that they don't have on these kinds of contracts, which may be problematic. So I think that in general, this is a major issue. And the real question for me, and maybe I'll just pose it to you, is what effect it might have, right? We've seen now, I don't know, half a dozen of these kind of contracting issues that we know about on scale that's reaching millions of dollars. Is it going to have an effect on the election, or is this something people just don't have on their radars?
You know, you and I have talked about this before. One of the things that has baffled me is that as popular as the governor is personally, he is getting no, I think, fallback or criticism for just the absolute train wreck that Texas state government has become. We've seen scandal after scandal in everything from Health and Human Services, the Texas Education Agency, Children's Protective Services, the Alcohol Beverage Commission, everything that the governor, his appointees have controlled, have essentially been mired in contract allegations of fraud, misuse, executive directors being fired and hired inappropriately. There is a problem in Texas government. It is not working correctly. But for whatever reason, there's been no political price, in large part, I think, because the governor doesn't really have a credible opponent going against him.
Yeah.
And the Democrats have chosen, for whatever reason, to not go after the administrative problems associated with state government and are more interested in kind of larger policy and priority problems.
Yeah. To be fair, now, the agency removed its contracts, division director. It also added attorneys with procurement experience. This is reported by the Texas Tribune. So things are being moved in the right direction. But this is all a fire drill, right? This isn't like a proactive effect. So to me, I think you're exactly right. They're not in a position where they're actually making choices about what's best. They're simply reacting to things that go wrong. And that's not a good way to govern, right? Especially in a state like this that relies so much on this. Jay, there was other news this week too, and especially related to the courts, on fetal remains. What happened there?
Well, we know during the last legislative session, SB 8 was passed, which dealt with burial requirements for fetal remains, whether that's through through abortions or through miscarriages or any other medical procedure. It placed a huge burden on family members who have just lost a potential child. And the courts had very quickly filed a preliminary injunction. Mm-hmm. Well, now that injunction is permanent. SB 8 is no longer as it relates to this, and it's considered a big victory. This is part of a larger campaign, I think, to attack and make it more difficult for abortion access in Texas.
Yeah.
This was meant as a way to kind of prevent those services, to make it more uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been deemed an undue burden on women. And so it's now, there's a permanent injunction in place, and they're going to have to go back to the drawing board. Clearly will be appealed.
Yes.
But it is no longer the law of the land.
Yeah. The argument here is interesting to me. The judge seemed to imply that the kind of shame that was associated with having to make decisions about the burial of the fetal remains was an undue burden or a possible undue burden. This is the kind of thing that a court might want to take up specifically. The question for us is, of course, whether that appeal process goes all the way to the top. You assume it will, given the political orientation of the attorney general. But we're going to have a new Supreme Court, Jay. And so it could be that this is the kind of case that ends up getting all the way up to the top. And it could be that it rules potentially in Texas's favor, especially if the courts are unconvinced by the notion that, like, the shaming associated with the burial and the decisions about that are essentially an undue burden, which is not permittable.
Well, Brandon, this election cycle, we've got a bunch of races here in play here in Texas at the congressional level. We did not expect that. We know we've got three, one in the Valley area, one in Dallas, and of course, one in Houston in the form of CD7. But there's a race in kind of the suburban part of Houston, CD22, Katy, Sugarland, Pearland.
It's a really wide district, right?
Yeah, really wide kind of suburban district that's kind of a bit sprawling. It's currently held by Congressman Pete Olson. This is famously Tom DeLay's old district,
right,
and where I grew up. And it is suddenly looking like it's getting some national attention and play. Sri Kulkarni, who is a retired Foreign Service officer, is the Democratic nominee and is giving Pete Olson fits on this district. A lot of it, I think, is derived from the fact that he's Asian American, and there's the largest Asian American population in the state, highly educated population. He's looking to flip the district. Trump carried it by about 6 points. Mm-hmm. What's your take?
I think that this is a good race to watch, but it'll be a good race to watch in 2020 as opposed to 2018. Now, our friend Erica Greeter at the Houston Chronicle had profiled this, and also the Texas Observer had profiled this. It's a really interesting race. Now, you say that Kulkarni is retired. That implies he's older. He's not, right? He's only, what, like 30, 35? He's really smart. He is a good candidate. They've campaigned, like, literally in a dozen different languages.
Yeah, he speaks like 6 or 7 languages. So.
I know. I'm jealous. To me, this is, like you say, a race to watch. I think it's going to be in the future because Fort Bend County is changing dramatically. Hillary Clinton won it over Donald Trump, which is pretty interesting. That diversity, I think, is driving much of that. But I looked at the numbers for the primary. All of the Democrats in the primary got something like 30,000 votes together. Olson himself got 36,000 votes. That's not even counting the extra 10,000 votes from the other Republicans. So I just think numerically it's a hard district to win right now. But if we see this matchup repeated in 2020, I think that you could see that this seat would flip blue.
Yeah, I think I would not be surprised if Kulkarni is not able to pull it off in 18. He certainly should make a go at it in 20 because he will be an even stronger candidate. But I will tell you that to me is a bit of a national bellwether. If you're seeing the shifts among college-educated women shifting to Democrats, if you're seeing the shift among more minority voters, particularly Asian Americans, shifting towards Democrats, this could be a harbinger of really interesting things.
Yeah.
And again, we've said this before, we're not sure how much that blue wave is going to affect Texas. But we know there's a Beto wave, a little of one.
Right.
So we'll see if it washes ashore on in CD22.
And the suburbs are changing, right? And that's not just in 22, but also in 7, like you said. It's in 23 or in Dallas. So if that sustains itself, the Democrats could be in better shape. Well, Jay, we'd all like to be in better shape financially, and nobody really likes paying taxes. And you know who in particular doesn't like paying taxes? Greg Abbott, right?
Exactly. In the department of, no, I have not surprised by hearing this message, Governor Abbott announced that under no circumstances would he ever support an income tax here in Texas. Well, I don't think anybody was thinking he was hedging his bets on that.
Right.
Now, the important thing about it is that the governor in an op-ed in the Dallas Morning News had talked about the need for more money in public education. First time really since George Bush's first term that we've had a Republican governor say we need more money in public education. But by ruling it out, I think what he's effectively saying is we need big property tax reform, and that property tax reform will probably involve sales taxes and the expansion of other things. But under no circumstances will it ever be an income tax.
That's a great question. I mean, maybe implicitly he's suggesting that there's going to be a plan in place. He said he wants to change the Constitution so that the voters can't approve it even if they wanted to. Higher taxes is like a political death in Texas, right? And Ben Barnes is a good example of that. I've got a bumper sticker in my office that says bread tax Barnes because, like, although Sharpstown undid his political career, like the fact that he had introduced legislation to add tax extra groceries was a real problem. Bob Bullock, the former lieutenant governor, got in big political trouble for this too. He said after he got battered for suggesting maybe there would be an income tax, that there are only two ways that Texas would get an income tax. Number one, if a Russian submarine sailed into the Houston Ship Channel, or number two, the business community demanded it. I don't see either of those things happening, certainly not before the election, right?
Well, Brandon, we know back in the 2016 race, our Senator Ted Cruz was accused of a lot of shenanigans in Iowa. Donald, that's where the lack of love between President Trump and Ted Cruz initially began. The Beto O'Rourke campaign is accusing the Cruz folks of some dirty tricks as well. Apparently, there's a Beto imposter out there sending out text messages. If you're out there and you're a voter, you might have already received a bunch of Beto, you know, come volunteer for Beto O'Rourke. Well, someone has taken that lead and suggested that he is trying to encourage undocumented immigrants to vote as a means to turn off voters.
Yeah.
They're accusing Cruz. Cruz folks are saying, we don't know anything about it.
Yeah. Well, when you crowdsource this stuff, you're going to find a lot of people who are going to want to, we call it in the business a certain term. I won't use the term since we're like public family radio, but it's rat blanking, right? You can look it up for yourself. This happened a lot in the like 70s, especially the Nixon campaign. Hey, politics, to quote Tom T. Hall, is a hard line. Like, it's going to get rough and tumble. And this suggests to me that even if it's not the case that this ends up being a close race, the fact that there's all this attention to it is going to make it pretty vicious. And so this is going to be, I think, just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, I think to me, this just, again, reinforces that this race is close. Whether it ends up that way, we'll see. But at least in the mind of the Cruz campaign, it's certainly close because they are putting on the full court press right now.
Speaking of close races, we've got a speaker's race. Just this week, we had a Four Price, a representative from the Lubbock area, and then Drew Darby throw their hat into the ring for Speaker of the Texas House. It's going to be a fight.
I think it will be. Darby in particular, I think, is an interesting candidate. He's the one guy who might be able to kind of bridge, especially he's going to create a coalition with Democrats. That certainly might be.
Yeah.
He might be the candidate best suited to do that. And I certainly think he would be considered one of the favorites. We still have John Zerwas out there in Fort Bend, who's been mentioned as a potential candidate. He's kind of in the same mm-hmm. vein as a Drew Darby.
Mm-hmm. And Speaker Strauss allies.
Another Speaker Strauss ally.
That's a kiss of death, though. That's worse than the D word you said, the Democrats, right?
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, we talked about this. I mean, we're going to see some more. Democrats are likely to pick up 5, potentially 6 House seats.
Yeah.
They may get close to 60.
Yeah.
If you are a minority speaker, because we know that that's essentially how Strauss originally got in. He did not have a majority of his initial caucus. If that you want to continue with that strategy, that's still a viable strategy. Neither Darby nor Zerwas have agreed to sign this pledge that says you have to agree with what the Republican caucus says.
Yeah.
And so Darby might be an interesting candidate. For Price, I don't know, Brandon, what's your take on him?
I think he's my pick, frankly, and always was. I think he'd be the consensus candidate. He's definitely somebody who is conservative enough. But this could be just a bit of a smokescreen, right? You've got a lot of moderates in there, and I think that's going to draw attention away from Price, who probably would be the consensus from conservative and moderate side. So that's my guess, but we'll see. This is going to have to be a fairly strong internal fight, and we'll see how it shakes out. But that's not the end of it, Jay. The last thing on our list here is an interesting shoe-related controversy that has reached Texas. What's going on?
Well, our esteemed Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick is boycotting Nike, joining the maelstrom that has erupted over an ad campaign featuring Colin Kaepernick. All I will say on that subject is when people are more incensed about an advertising campaign for shoes than they are about school shootings here in Texas, then we have very big problems.
Right. Just don't do it. This is the new tagline for the Dan Patrick campaign. But you're right. This is the kind of social politics that's really driving much of what's happening in the election. And it's certainly taking us away from the issues that really affect. But it's good politics for a base election like the Republicans think it's going to be.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to dive into the contentious Kavanaugh hearings and let you know what's happening there and what the politics of it are all about.
So, Jay, the big news of the week, of course, are the hearings for the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to be on the Supreme Court. Let's talk big picture here. What are we seeing in terms of the first couple of days, and what are the impacts of this process as well as potentially a Kavanaugh Supreme Court?
Well, there's a couple of things that stuck out to me. One is the Democrats are essentially trying to fight kind of two separate battles here. One, they have a base constituency that really wants to vociferously oppose this.
Yes.
So they need to put on, for lack of a better word, as much sound and fury out there about opposing this nomination, recognizing that they lack the numerical numbers themselves to create a hard stop. There's mm-hmm. no way they can stop it if every Republican votes for it.
Mm-hmm.
The second part of it is that you've got this specter, not just of the court and what the ramifications are of Kavanaugh getting on, but you've got sort of the posturing of a 2020 election
yeah.
cycle. And in some ways, that comes back to what we're talking about with activists. You've got a sense now that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party really wants a fight on it. So you're seeing, I think, pretty extended performances and questioning by folks like Cory Booker and Kamala Harris that are likely 2020 candidates or potential 2020 candidates. This would allow them to kind of shine.
Yeah.
And then the last thing is there's a legitimate sort of policy issue here at play. There are questions about the amount of documents that have been released. There are lots of memos at his time. Brett Kavanaugh is unique from previous judicial candidates in that he essentially lived a good chunk of his professional life as a political professional and partisan political professional.
Yeah.
He was a major player in the Bush, George W. Bush White House, serving as sort of the secretary in charge of all of the documentation that was flowing in to the West Wing. His name is on a lot of documents, and there are things on those documents that he clearly doesn't want, and I'm sure George W. Bush and the folks around him don't want released.
Yeah.
And so all of that creates, I think, a huge kind of kabuki theater, for lack of a better word, where you've got the Republicans sort of pushing back aggressively against the Democrats really wanting to kind of dust it up. But at the end of the day, the Republicans have the numbers, and with 52 Republicans, unless they can peel away two or three, nothing matters.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I want to add another layer to your tres leches cake, and that is that Trump's attacks on the judiciary are also kind of front and center to this, right? I mean, he has been very vocal against his own Justice Department. He has called out judges in the past for being so-called judges. He has replaced U.S. attorneys. He has also suggested that there's a litmus test on Roe v. Wade. So I think in a lot of ways, this is a kind of, I don't know, a proxy war for Trump's handling of judicial issues, as well as the bigger question, which is that like the Trump administration is going to potentially get to staff about a third of the total federal judiciary, like all the way down the train. So I think that's one issue, too. The question here, I think, is a good one that you pose, and that is kind of what can the Democrats accomplish? I mean, I think that, like you say, it's clear that many of these folks are running for higher office, right? Kamala Harris and Cory Booker. But you also have Dianne Feinstein, who's going to have a pretty tough general election because of their process. She's running against a Democrat in the general. So she's got a lot at stake as well. But I do think that they're able to kind of force the Republicans into a corner and make them take a harder vote than it would have been before the hearing. And that's something that could be a political issue. And I don't think that Trump minds the fight. I mean, I think in general, he's pugnacious. But I think in particular, this is one of those big issues where the Republicans can win on and that they really want to push for. So I definitely think that they don't mind having all this friction, all the demonstrators. That plays to their favor.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to tell you what we think is going to happen in this hearing and what the political consequences might be.
So Jay, the big news of the week, obviously, is the hearings on Brett Kavanaugh. Why do people care about this, and what's the real impact?
Well, look, the big impact here is some of the major issues that are facing this country get decided at the Supreme Court. Brett Kavanaugh is taking over for Anthony Kennedy, who is the reported sort of the swing vote on many key issues. And so he really matters. It's a role that has sort of evolved as kind of the one variable on the Supreme Court. I think ultimately he's going to get passed in large part unless something happens in the next 48 hours or so where they are able to get something. Democrats are able to find something out that dissuades or makes it more difficult for Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski to vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
But even with that, those two, you're now then at a 50-50 situation. So a tie vote that will then be cast by the vice president.
How do you think pencil vote?
Yes.
Unless he's the anonymous
op-ed
writer.
By the vice president of the United States. So that combination makes it really hard.
Yeah, unless he's the anonymous op-ed writer, in which case this is his way to like stop the president. I think you're exactly right. As the political process has become gridlocked, this is where all the action will be politically and in terms of policy. So that's why it's important. But I think it's important for Texas, too. Many cases that the state is involved in with respect to abortion, which we talked about, or DACA, or Obamacare, which is being debated this week, too, or being heard this week, too, are all going to be part of the Texas political scene. And the Supreme Court will be really on point here in checking an aggressive legislature or in altering what the attorney general wants to do. So it matters a lot to Texas in particular.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
A big thanks to our executive producer, Don Geraci. Special kudos to our web whiz, Giselle Bueno, and our graphics guru, Michelle Lamb. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the Sherpa, Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.
This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District, Houston's hidden gem, with a developer-friendly environment and Houston's sixth largest business center. More information at nnmd.org.